It's Tuned to Yesterday, broadcasting programs from radio's golden age. Welcome, I'm your host, Mark Levonier. True History, coming up in this hour. Later on, we hear Norman Corwin's An American in England via CBS and Shortwave. But right now, it's Adventures in Research. This long-running series from Westinghouse Syndication produced well over 600 broadcasts with biography, stories of invention, and this tale called Victory in the Desert, talking about the beginnings of Phoenix, Arizona. This first turn on September 21st, 1954.
Adventures in Research. This is Paul Shannon bringing you another transcribed story of science produced as a public service in cooperation with the Westinghouse Research Laboratories. And today telling you the story of one of the outstanding achievements in the winning of the American Southwest. It is not the story of a victory over the Indians, but of a victory over a more relentless, implacable foe, the desert. The city of Phoenix, Arizona is today a busy, thriving community. Capital of the state, it is an important shipper of cotton and vegetables. It nestles in Arizona's Salt River Valley, irrigated by water from the Salt River itself. It is also a world-famous health resort. But time was when Phoenix was anything but a health resort. The scorching heat of the desert made it almost impossible to live there. And the early settlers found themselves faced with a major problem, water. And so in 1867, one of the early American settlers in the valley organized an irrigation company. And for several years, the Salt River Valley prospered. 200,000 acres were reclaimed from the desert, and living conditions were much improved. This, then, is a good time to begin our story. A time when the men of the valley thought the battle with the desert was over, won with hardly a fight. We are back in the year 1889, in a general store in the busy little town of Phoenix itself. As usual, it's a hot, dry summer day. The kind of day when men and animals seek whatever shelter they can find.
Hi, Ed. Ain't seen you in a month of Sundays. How are you?
Okay, Jim.
How's the wife and kids?
Good.
Everything okay on the farm?
Yep.
Hot enough for you?
It sure is. 108 right outside the door. That's hot enough for anybody.
You bet your life. Tell me, how's crops?
Not bad, Jim.
What you raising?
We're cotton, mostly. A few acres of vegetables here and there.
Getting all the water you need?
Well, yes and no.
What do you mean, Ed?
Oh, nothing, I guess. When you add it all up at the end of the year, I guess I am getting enough water. Trouble is, it ain't steady. Seems like just when I need it most, I get the least.
Shucks, Ed. That's nothing to beef about. Like you just said, when you add it up at the end of the year, you are getting enough.
It isn't that. It's just that ever since I moved into this valley, I've thought we ought to find a way to store water so we'd always be sure of a steady supply. So in case anything ever happens, we'll be safe.
Safe? Safe from what? Ain't nothing gonna happen, Ed. Salt River's got plenty of water, and you know it.
Yeah, maybe so. We're not getting one quarter what we should be getting.
Now, don't say that. We got the river pretty well dammed up, ain't we?
Just a few dams made out of rocks and brush, that's all. If we ever had a flood, they'd bust in no time.
Well, what do you have in mind?
What we need in the Salt River Valley is a real dam made of stone and cement. One that'll store up so much water we'll never have to worry.
And who's going to build it?
Well, right now, I don't know.
And what's more, who's going to pay for it? Don't know that neither, do you?
Now, hold on, Jim.
Wait a minute, Ed. I like you. I always have and always will, but I've heard that kind of talk from you so much I'm getting tired of it. We're getting along okay here in the Salt River Valley. Maybe our dams ain't made of stone and cement, but they work good enough for us. We've taken more than 200,000 acres away from the desert. We've grown crops on them, yes, sir. And anybody who don't like it here can just get up and go, and the sooner the better. Now, Ed, you listen to me. You're a smart young fella, and you've got a lot of common sense. Hey, Ed! Well, I'll be darned. Walked right out of the store. And he never bought a nickel's worth of nothing.
Edwin's right on talking about the need for a real dam. He did more than talk. He even picked out a good location. But as long as there was plenty of water in the river, nothing was ever done about it. After all, people said, why not leave well enough alone? We're doing all right. And all the while, the desert listened and bided its time. In 1897, it struck its first blow, drought. No rain in the valley, no rain in the mountains. The water in the Salt River grew lower and lower. People waited, but there was no rain. 2 years passed, 1898, 1899, and still drought. Meanwhile, cattle died, fruit trees died, crops withered, and families moved away in droves. To guard the dwindling water supply, armed men patrolled the irrigation ditches. 75,000 acres of once fertile soil were forced out of cultivation as the desert returned to claim its land. In February 1900, Ed's prediction came true. A flash flood swept away every dam on the river. In March of that same year, a dust storm. Clouds of dust hovered over the valley. Thick, heavy, throat-parching dust. The desert's gesture of triumph. Its signal of final victory. Stunned by the fury of the desert attack, the men of the valley sadly assembled in a town meeting to decide their future. The chairman of the meeting, the Phoenix storekeeper, called the citizens to order.
Men, ain't no need to say why we're here. You all know as well as I do. We're here because we're running out of water. Because our cattle and our crops is dying. Because we just can't live here no more. My advice to each and every one of you is to get out now.
Mr. Chairman, mind if I say a few words?
Go right ahead. Speak your mind all you want to.
Thank you. Men, my name's Ben Fowler. Most of you hardly know me. Up until a few months ago, I lived in the East. But I've come out here to settle down in your valley, and I just want to say this. I know how it feels to lose cattle and crops. I know how it feels when you can't spare your kids a drink of water. But I tell you, we can save this valley, and now's the time to start.
That's so, Mr. Fowler. Well, suppose you tell us exactly how to do it.
By building an honest-to-goodness dam that'll hold.
Mr. Fowler, we've heard that talk around here
before. All right, now wait a minute. Now, just wait a minute. I've talked this over with engineers, and we have a plan. Not only that, we have a site picked out.
Where?
The Tonto River Basin, right near where the Tonto empties into the Salt River.
Mr. Fowler, that's 65 miles from the nearest railroad. You'd never get your equipment up there.
Well, I think we could.
Even if you did. That there's the steepest gorge on the whole river. You couldn't build nothing there.
My engineer friend thinks it can be done.
Well, how much do you figure it'd cost?
Oh, about $5 million.
$5 million?
Hold on. I know as well as you that there isn't $5 million in the whole territory. So I've got another idea. Now, if I tell you, ma'am, we may be able to raise the money elsewhere, would you consider staying on here in the valley and working for this dam?
What'll we do in the meantime? Where'll we get water?
Rebuild the rock and brush dams that were destroyed by the flood. And while you're doing that, I personally will try to raise the money. Now, is that a bargain? No.
Just a minute, Mr. Fowler. Before you ask everybody to stay here in the valley on your say-so, we got a right to ask a question. Where do you figure to get this money? That's one answer we want to hear.
Okay, I'll tell you. I think we can get the money from the federal government in Washington.
You mean you'll go to Washington yourself?
Yes, and what's more, I'll stay there until I find someone who realizes we've got to have water. Now, is that good enough?
It's good enough for me, Mr. Fowler.
Good. Now, all you men who are willing to stay in this valley until I come back from Washington, All you men say aye.
Aye.
All right. All right, then it's settled. I'll leave tomorrow morning. And if necessary, I'll take this matter clear up to the President of the United States, Teddy Roosevelt himself.
So Ben Fowler went to Washington, where he talked to everyone who would listen. Most people listened sympathetically and then went about their business. But there were two men who were anxious to do more than listen. They wanted to turn words into action. One was a man who was dedicated to the cause of land reclamation, a man named George Maxwell. The other, an important ally and friend of Maxwell's, Congressman Newlands. A meeting between Newlands and Fowler was finally arranged, a meeting that proved to be an historic one.
Now, Mr. Fowler, before we go any further, I want you to know I'm on your side. I think the Salt River Valley must be irrigated, and I think it's the government's duty to help. What's more, the president thinks so, too.
Oh, he does?
He certainly does. You know how Teddy Roosevelt feels about the West. Well, he'd think he was born out there.
Well, that's mighty good to hear, Congressman.
Well, it doesn't hurt any. But we need more than that. We need facts and figures. Now, you say this dam will cost $5 million.
Yes.
A lot of money, Mr. Fowler.
Yes, I know, but look what it'll mean to the nation, Congressman. I don't hesitate to say that a dam on the Salt River will mean more to the United States than all California's gold, Colorado's silver, and Arizona's copper, and I mean every word.
I think you're right, Fowler. The only trouble is, where will we get the money? Oh, I know. You'll say, let Congress appropriate the money. Well, let me tell you this. The minute a territory like Arizona gets $5 million, every state in the Union will want some.
Yeah, that's what everybody tells me.
And they're right. No two ways about it.
Yeah, I guess they are. And I think it's time I went back to the Valley because there isn't any more I can do here in Washington.
Oh, wait a minute, Mr. Fowler. We're not giving up that easily. After all, Arizona's a mighty big place. Going to be a state someday. Lots of land out there.
Oh, there sure is. Lots of public land, too. Land owned by the federal government. Say, Congressman, that gives me an idea. Why couldn't the federal government put some of that land up for sale and use the proceeds to build our dam?
Well, no reason at all. By George, that's it. The government sells the land and the cost of the dam is paid for. Fowler, if I were you, I'd stay right here in Washington to see the Newlands Reclamation Act become a law.
On June 17th, 1902, a telegraph instrument in Phoenix ticked the happy news that the Newlands Reclamation Act had been signed by the president. People forgot their personal interests and began to work together in harmony. They set up in advance the details of a plan for the equitable distribution of the water that would be supplied to them by a dam which was not even built yet. Since the site was 65 miles from the nearest railroad, a road had to be built to transport supplies and machinery. Every single ton was hauled in high-wheeled wagons drawn by old-fashioned mule trains. Almost 350,000 cubic yards of stone were cut from the mountainside. 184 feet at the base, 16 feet at the top. The dam stretched more than 1,000 feet across the mouth of a gorge. It impounded 1,400,000 acre-feet of floodwater. Begun in 1906, the huge main dam was completed in 1911 and dedicated on March 18th of that same year. On that day, it was officially named the Roosevelt Dam in honor of President Theodore Roosevelt. Since 1911, land reclamation has continued in the United States, but it took Roosevelt Dam to convince people that reclamation was practical. It was the result of the resolution of a group of determined men who turned a raw wasteland into a thriving, prosperous community. Winning a victory in the desert was their adventure in research. And that's today's Adventures in Research, produced in cooperation with the Westinghouse Research Laboratories.
Adventures and Research on Tuned to Yesterday from September 21st, 1954 from Westinghouse Syndication.
How do you do, ladies and gentlemen? This is Knox Manning in Hollywood taking you on another brief journey behind the scenes. Once again, we draw the curtain to watch a fragment of forgotten drama, a story of people and places already hidden in the background of destiny. Today, we shall meet a shopkeeper who turned from dismal failure to a brilliant career. But before that, a word from a familiar voice.
You are listening to an hour of true history on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levonier.
There's a man who knows what he's talking about. And now step with me behind the scenes to the back room of a small shop. The cubby holes of the battered roll-top desk are stuffed with multicolored invoices. The flickering light from the gas jet casts dancing shadows over the words stamped on each bill. The fateful words, account past due, please remit. The shopkeeper, his eyes reddened with lack of sleep, his brow furrowed with concern, is adding a column of figures. As he finishes, he looks up and runs his hand through his hair in a characteristic gesture. Let's step beside him and check his addition. It was all over now. He'd failed. That was quite clear from the stock that had lain on his shelves for weeks, from the ever-dwindling number of customers, and most of all, from the red ink column of the ledger in front of him. He should never have tried to run a store in the first place. He was basically a farm boy, and he supposed that's where he should have stayed, raising chickens and milking cows, planting in the spring and reaping in the fall. Well, he was going back to his farm. He had just enough money left to pay his bills and to get his family moved back to the country. Just that much remained, but no more. Suddenly, the door behind him swung open. A short, fat, moon-faced man in his early 40s waddled into the little room. "What's happened here?" he asked. "Where are the customers?" The shopkeeper, in halting sentences, explained that there were no customers and would be none, explained that his store had failed. The heavy-set man raised his bushy eyebrows. "So you're closing up, eh? Well, what are you going to do with all this stock you have left?" The merchant smiled sadly. "Give it away, I guess. Nobody wants to buy it." "That seems rather foolish," the other man interjected. "You've got a couple of $100 tied up here." "I'll tell you what. I passed through a little town the other day, saw an empty store. It looks like good business property to me. Now you could rent that place for, maybe a week or so and sell off this merchandise. Keep the prices low. You won't get rich, but you'll get rid of this junk, and it's better than throwing away your whole investment." The shopkeeper hesitated, thinking, wondering, and then hoping. It might be worth the time. He'd do his best to dispose of his remaining stock. He'd try for a couple of weeks. He had nothing to lose, and the money would come in handy. He'd risk 2 weeks of it, but no more. After that, he was going back to the farm. So the young entrepreneur loaded his goods and his family into a wagon and set out for Lancaster, Pennsylvania, to sell the remnants of his fling at shopkeeping. He opened the empty store, put up his displays, and in a few days had sold off most of his merchandise at very cheap prices. Then, instead of closing as he'd planned, he reordered. And that shop in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, stayed open, not just for 2 weeks. It's still running, still providing to the local housewives, and is quite famous as the oldest of America's 5- and 10-cent stores, a store that was established to dispose of surplus goods by that failing shopkeeper, F.W. Woolworth. This is Knox Manning inviting you to join me again tomorrow at this time for another journey into that dim half-light where chance and destiny lift men out from behind the scenes. This is a Hamilton Whitney radio production, transcribed in Hollywood.
Next on Tuned to Yesterday, An American in England. This is a very ambitious series, penned and directed by Norman Corwin, produced by newsman Edward R. Murrow, originating from the BBC and broadcast via shortwave over CBS Radio. At this point in history, radio writer Norman Corwin was already considered its poet laureate, producing drama and verse on the Columbia Workshop program and other shows dedicated to his work. And when the Second World War broke out, he happened to have prepared a program just a week after the bombing of Pearl Harbor called We Hold These Truths, which was a tribute to the Bill of Rights, tuned in by tens of millions across the country at a time where they needed to hear that reminder of what America stood for, now entering one of its most major conflicts. In the following year, he would produce the This Is War series, which was broadcast over 700 stations on all four major networks, bringing portraits, hopeful and at times grim, of what the war was like overseas. To that end, Corwin spent 4 months in England on sort of a fact-finding mission for the subsequent series An American in England, and said of his time there, quote, "I did not once interview a high government official. The main objective of the series was to establish the character of the British people and not disseminate the handouts of the Ministry of Information. The people were soldiers, sailors, workers, miners, the theater manager, the elevator man, police officer Gilbert, the Everingtons, the Westerbys, Betty Hardy, the actress, Henry Blogg, the lifesaver, Mary Seaton, the newspaper woman, the RAF officer who handed me a dish in the mess and explained this sausage is made of two ingredients, paper and sawdust, the navigator, just returned from Wilhelmshaven, who said wistfully, "Somehow we're always first over the target," the woman in Swansea, who went to the Guildhall one morning following a severe blitz and turned in two suits of clothes, both nearly new, saying she had bought them for her two boys, killed in the raid. End quote. 10 episodes of An American in England were produced, with Corwin working closely with the journalistic sense of producer Edward R. Murrow. So, although dramatized, this is a true story you'll hear next, with episode number 5, broadcast on August 31st, 1942.
We take you now to England.
Well, 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 Mac Nyan.
Certainly good to see you, Mac.
And it's well to see you, kid. So last time I saw you was in New Haven at the Dartmouth game. Remember?
Sure do.
That was the day they played that 33-33 tie. Say, guess who's over here?
Who?
Mary Munford. You remember her from Springfield.
No kidding. What's she doing here?
She's with the Red Cross.
Well, what do you know? Tell you who else is over here. You know Jerry Chatterov.
Sure, saw him in Hollywood a couple of months ago.
Well, he's with the Air Force. And Bunny Hill used to work for BBD&O?
Yeah.
She's with the American Embassy.
Sure seems like home, doesn't it?
Just stand on Piccadilly Circus long enough and you're bound to meet your old school teacher.
Columbia Broadcasting System presents An American in England, the fifth of a limited series of 6 programs written and directed by Norman Corwin, produced by Edward R. Murrow, and broadcast from somewhere in the British Isles. Joseph Julian narrates, and the original musical score is by Benjamin Britten. Tonight, the Yanks are here. We can't tell you how many hundreds of thousands of Americans there are in this island. But it's going to be the greatest migration of free-fighting men the world has ever seen. Men who have come straight through the battle of the Atlantic to Europe's one piece of free soil where free men may still fight for freedom. They came to fight. This is not their final destination. But this isn't just a huge flying field and parade ground. There are people living here. It's their home. Their sons are training alongside our boys. They go on leave together. They speak our language, or near enough. If they can live and fight together, it's a good bet they'll work together when all this has passed away. This is the record. So far.
Sit in a pub on the English Channel, across the way from the barbarians, and you listen to an American folk song called Arkansas Traveler. It's coming at you over the British radio. Earlier, they were playing records of Guy Lombardo and Fats Waller and the Golden Gate Quartet. But now they're playing Arkansas Traveler.
The tune sets you to some idle wondering. How far would an Arkansas traveler have to travel from Arkansas in order to hear the Arkansas traveler over the British radio at a point within a Spitfire's spitting distance of France? Answer, about 5,000 miles as a bomber flies and considerably farther as a convoy zigzags. It occurs to you that a good many travelers from Arkansas have already made the trip, along with a lot of guns from Bridgeport and tanks from Baton Rouge and oil from Pennsylvania and some fine sides of beef from the packing houses of Chicago. In fact, there's so much that's American on this island. As for example, this private, United States Army, drinking a beer and reading a newspaper. What's funny, soldier?
Huh? Oh, well, it mightn't strike you funny unless you're an American.
I am an American.
Oh, well, then, take a look at this.
He hands you a copy of a London paper. There's an article entitled...
Now, if you meet an American,
It offers advice to the British on how to behave should they meet up with an ally from across the big sea water.
When you see an American, don't yell, "Look, there's an American," at the top of your voice. And if you treat an American to a lot more drinks than he wants, but feels bound to accept out of politeness, don't wax indignant for the rest of your days if he loosens up a bit after the fifth round.
Yeah, this is all right.
Don't try to tell an American that he ought to pronounce English the way you do. His tongue is closer to the one Shakespeare spoke than yours. Nelson, thank God he had done his duty, not duty. That was an affectation that caught on after Beau Brummel had started it among the old school tie set of 1810.
See the one there about the coffee? You read on.
It's a waste of time to try to convince an American that the stuff passing under that name over here is coffee. He knows better. They don't have tea as a meal in America, but if you offer them some, they won't say no.
Funny thing about that, the booklet the Army gave us says practically the same thing, only in reverse.
What booklet?
Oh, haven't you seen it? Booklet to how to get along with the British.
He pulls a small pamphlet out of his back pocket and thumbs through its well-worn leaves to page 9. Then he points to a paragraph which reads,
"The British don't know how to make a good cup of coffee. You don't know how to make a good cup of tea. It's an even swap."
You say the Army hands these out?
Sure.
It's on the cover.
On the cover, it says simply,
"Britain, for all members of the American Expeditionary Forces in Great Britain."
Read what it says there about differences.
Where? Right there on the same page.
You locate it and read,
"When you find differences between British and American ways of doing things, there is usually a good reason for them. British railways have dinky freight cars, not because they don't know any better. Small cars allow quicker handling of freight at thousands of small stations."
You mind if I read this through?
No, go ahead. There's no military secrets in it.
You start, appropriately enough, at the beginning. And there, under the heading of introduction, is a very clear statement of the case. It has the same kind of impact as a good fanfare.
"We are now in Great Britain as part of an Allied offensive to meet Hitler and beat him on his own ground."
"For the time being, you'll be Britain's guest."
"For the time being." Any connection between this phrase and the jitters shown by Goebbels lately? You read on.
"America and Britain are allies. Hitler knows that they, with the other United Nations, mean his crushing defeat in the end. So it is only common sense to understand that the first duty Hitler's given his propaganda chiefs is to separate Britain and America and spread distrust between them. If he can do that, his chance of winning might return."
The long chance. But the whole history of Hitler has been a long chance.
"We can defeat Hitler's propaganda with a weapon of our own. Plain common horse sense, understanding of evident truths. The most evident truth of all is that in their major ways of life, the British and American people are much alike. They speak the same language."
"How's that again?"
"They both believe in representative government, freedom of worship, freedom of speech. But each country has minor national characteristics which differ."
Schedule, banana.
"It is by causing misunderstanding over these minor differences that Hitler hopes to make his propaganda effective. You defeat enemy propaganda not by denying that these differences exist, but by admitting them openly and then trying to understand them."
Aha! That puts a finger on one of the things of which the United Nations will be most proud when the history of this war is told, the strategy of truth. We've never had to lie the way the Axis has about our losses and gains. We've never had to contradict ourselves 5 or 6 times a day like the maggoty ministers of the Wilhelmstrasse. We've never had to jam the ether so our own people couldn't hear the news. Jamming, by the way, is an Axis monopoly and can be heard all around the dial of an ordinary radio set in England. It sounds like this. That's so the mothers of Berlin won't hear the news that 45,000 Nazis were killed in the newest Russian counteroffensive west of Moscow.
That's so the French won't hear that the Yanks in Britain have started bombing operations with flying fortresses over Nazi-held France. Our side doesn't have to jam the Axis. Lord Haw-Haw can babble all night on the Allied air if he's a mind to. Nobody here or in the States would waste a radio transmitter's time and energy smudging out the bray of a fascist ass. Come to think of it, the Axis has very little imagination. If the British wanted to jam anybody, they'd at least do it with sounds appropriate to whoever was being jammed, the jammee. For instance, Hitler. Or a little motif for Bullfrog Mussolini. Say, you through with the pamphlet, Mac? I gotta be going.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just sort of daydreaming.
Thanks for letting me read it.
Oh, that's okay. So long, Mac.
So long. Take it easy.
What a thing to say to an American soldier in this war. Take it easy.
To an American Red Cross club. You sit in a lounge, waiting for a friend who's in the U.S. Navy. At the piano, a soldier sadly plunking away with one finger. He stops and turns around.
Somehow it sounds better when Rachmaninoff plays it.
That's just what I was thinking.
Got a cigarette, bud?
Yeah, sure. There you are. What's the matter? You look kind of blue.
I am blue.
Why?
I've been here 4 months and had only 2 letters from home.
Oh, that's tough. Why only 2 letters?
I don't know. Folks must be pretty busy, I guess.
Yeah, but still.
Yeah, so have I been pretty busy for that matter. But I found time to write.
What have you been doing?
Oh, I was in on the Dieppe show.
You were? How was it?
You know, I think I could stand almost anything except not getting any mail from home.
A flyer sitting nearby looks up.
Sometimes people can be pretty careless when they do write. A friend of mine came back from bombing Abbeville one night, and he finds a letter from his girl saying she don't love him no more.
No, that's filthy.
Yeah, awful.
Certainly is.
Cheer up, Lenny. It can't be that bad.
If the folks back there only knew how much we depend on their mail, well, they'd write oftener. That's all I can say.
Oh, well.
In a restaurant, you overhear an argument between a lieutenant and a corporal from the States.
Ah, you're crazy.
Who's crazy?
I tell you, they're the most friendly people in the world.
Can I referee this match?
We're just arguing about hospitality. In my opinion, the...
Wait a minute. Listen to this. I was in Datchet one night. You know what?
Where's Datchet?
On the Thames, just below Windsor Castle. I was doing some sightseeing on my leave.
Well, I stopped for the night at this fine old tavern in Datchet, and I ate a terrific meal.
Cold salmon.
And I'm put up in a magnificent room.
Where Queen Elizabeth slept once.
Will you let me tell this story? And in the morning, I go downstairs and ask for the bill. And a woman comes over and says she's the proprietor. And she says...
Would you mind very much, Lieutenant, if I didn't accept any money from you?
So I say, oh, no, I couldn't do that. Thank you very much.
Well, I think it's the least I can do to express my personal appreciation of all that your country's done and is doing, and I wouldn't...
Yes, ma'am, that's very good of you, but after all, we're helping ourselves, and it's not just a...
Besides, you're a long way from home.
Well, that's very kind of you,
please.
But...
It would make me very happy.
Well, so what the heck? I put my door away. Now, that's what I call hospitality.
Oh, well, for that matter, a
conductor on a bus in Birmingham once refused to take my fare.
Well, what's the argument here? I thought there was an argument.
Well, you see, I think the Scotch are more hospitable than the English.
Ah, they're all the same, you dope. What's the difference? They're all British.
Well,
watched some American soldiers warming up noisily for a game of baseball in a city park. And there's a gallery of natives looking on with amusement and amazement. The boys are dressed in old sweatshirts, dungarees, polo shirts, a great variety of old rags. Some of them have their shirt tails hanging out. This sloppy dress offends a short, middle-aged Englishman standing next to you.
Why don't these men wear uniforms? Disgraceful the way they look. And on Sunday, too.
Well, don't you understand? They're just playing for fun. They're not giving a public exhibition or anything like that.
Well, there are hundreds of games all around Britain today. English boys playing all kinds of sports for the fun of it. And you won't find this ragtail appearance. They're all wearing uniforms of some kind.
Well, don't you see, these boys didn't have room to carry baseball uniforms with them. I dare say they had more important equipment to bring over.
Yes. Well, you've a point there.
He concedes that much. But still, he doesn't like the idea of baseball.
Well, frankly, I think it's a childish game. It's half affectation, I believe.
Affectation? Why?
Well, all that shouting and yelling, the way they throw the ball around to each other every time one of the players gets his hands on it, don't understand it at all. Very childish.
But they're not even playing yet. They're just warming up. That's infield practice. You see, the batter there is hitting grounders out to the infield. And they're just...
I still say, if you pardon me, it's a very childish game. Very childish.
Okay, it's childish. You find that the Yanks and their allies are picking up each other's language and learning each other's customs. This comes from crowding the same pubs, palling around in the airdromes, flying together, bumping into each other in the Strand and Trafalgar Square at country dances. It's not uncommon to hear a Tommy say,
"What's cooking, old boy?"
And they also say,
"How you doing, bud? Okay?"
Whereas the Yank has adopted such Briticisms as,
"Good show that, you know."
And,
"I take a very poor view of that sort of thing, actually."
He's also picked up petrol for gas and says underground for subway. And he's learned that circus, as in Piccadilly Circus, is the Latin for circle and not the English for Barnum and Bailey. He's also found that Britain is as full of dialects and accents as his own country. And that what would correspond to the Brooklyn accent in Britain is the London East End.
Blimey! Now is the time for all good men to come to the aid of the party.
And what would correspond to Midwestern, Iowa, Nebraska, and so forth, would be Midland.
Aye, it's champion. E by gum, now's the time for all good men to come to the aid of the party.
And the coal miner, the man who lives in the Pennsylvania and Kentucky of Britain, is the Welshman who sounds like this.
Indeed to goodness, now is the time for all good men to come to the aid of the party.
Whereas the way down east farmer of this island calls himself a Geordie. And sounds like this.
By gawks, man. Now's the time for all good men to come to the aid of the party.
Of course, what would correspond to the Canadian and his maple leaf would be the Scotsman and his thistle.
Now's the time for all good men to come to the aid of the party.
And there are a lot of other accents and dialects like Yorkshire, Suffolk, Devonshire, and Cornwall. They may have different accents, but they have a single purpose. To come to the aid of all parties interested in beating the Axis. Sure. You drink a ginger beer with a farmer from Buckinghamshire. And he tells you about three American soldiers from Northern Ireland.
Well, now, you see, our problem was this. Our wheat crop in Raysbury was so bulky that we couldn't operate the combine harvester. Do you know anything about farming?
No, I'm afraid not.
Well, this harvester is a machine that cuts and thrashes in one operation. We just got the machines from America, you see. And there aren't many of us farmers here knows how to use them yet. And we were having the very devil of a time trying to get it to work. And finally, do you know what we did?
What did you do?
Why, we appealed to the American Army for men who were experts at handling this particular machine. And do you know what?
What?
Why, they sent us three soldiers who were farmers back in the States. Gave them special leave to help us harvest that wheat.
How'd they make out?
Why, they went through those fields in no time. Do you know how long it took them, on an average, to cut and thrash an acre of wheat?
How long?
1 hour.
That's good, huh?
Good? Good? Why, man, it's a record. I've written to the Minister of Agriculture about it.
Well, that's swell. But did you get along all right with the boys? I mean, personally?
Personally? Why, the whole village got along with them. We were very sorry to see them go back to camp, I can tell you. And do you know something else?
What else?
They claimed, according to light of them, that American farmers owe pretty well everything they know about soil conservation to us British farmers. Did you know that, sir?
No, I never knew that.
Well, neither did I. So one of them said to me when I thanked him, he said, we're only paying you back, he says. We're only paying you back.
You spread out all the London papers, and when you've got them all spread out, they don't equal in size half the normal weekday edition of the New York Times. The paper shortage here isn't a fooling matter. And the biggest papers have to cram the news of the world, of England, of London, into four skimpy pages with pictures. But with all there is to report from the fronts of this busy war, big sections of the press are always being devoted to the subject of America and Americans. The Daily Herald has a lengthy interview with Major General Clark of the U.S. Army and quotes him as saying,
we have not come over to sit on our back ends and do nothing. We are here to take the offensive.
Another has a five-column layout with a caption,
what do Americans think of us?
And the subheading,
a number of American soldiers in Britain were asked for their candid, undoctored replies to seven questions. The response was completely frank and realistic. The News Chronicle hopes that it will help us to understand them better.
The Daily Mail carries a piece on the U.S. Marines under the bold-faced title,
Leathernecks.
From this British article, you learn for the first time how the Leathernecks got their name. Used to wear leather stocks around their necks to protect them from cutlasses. Goes to show you. The Express has a long illustrated article on Negro soldiers in Britain, in which it reports,
in the west of England, a stately mansion has stirred to new life. It is home and headquarters for a contingent of American colored troops. At night, Negro choruses float down the lanes as the night pass men come home. And at church parades, English congregations have heard the fervor of Negro spirituals sung by men who live in their songs. They drink in the Rose and Crown, the Horse and Hounds with the locals, treating and being treated. They go to concerts and cinemas. No place that is open to our own men is barred to them. And they're rather amazed at the friendliness of the entire countryside and the nearest big city.
A whole half page of a morning paper is taken up with a script of a transatlantic broadcast called An American in England. There are half a dozen articles every day on these interesting people who live in the 48 states between the Atlantic and Pacific. But not all these articles are admiring. One paper, observing that milk for the American army is being brought across the Atlantic, breaks into verse.
Bouquets to the farmers of Texas, deserving a roll on the drum, whose work on each udder must make Hitler shudder and dream of the vengeance to come. Give laurels to warriors hardy for battle and bottle athirst, who seem to have reckoned the front may be second, but pride of the palate comes first. And there, I was almost forgetting, some stokers and those of that ilk, whose blood, sweat, and toil were delivering oil, but now must deliver the milk.
Walk through the world's greatest city thinking the thoughts of an American in England. Here it is, the fourth year of the fight, coming up. Around you are the marks of the struggle. Bomb ruins, air raid shelters, barricades, barrage balloons. Around you are throngs of uniforms of the United Nations, men of the RAF, girls of the ATS. Not around are the 60,000 British men, women, and children killed by Nazi bombs. Not around are the Tommies left on the fields of France, in the Norwegian fjords, in the mountains of Greece, in the jungles of Malaya, on the Isle of Crete, in the waste of Libya, in the Syrian hills, in the waters of the Arctic, and in the gorges of Ethiopia. No, not around here now. But the Yanks are here. The Canadians are here. The North American delegation to Berlin is swarming over the city, the country, the camps, the aerodromes. They're here for a specific purpose.
We have not come over to sit on our back ends and do nothing. We are here to take the offensive.
They're young, these Yanks. They're confident. They're well equipped. They're the highest paid soldiers in the world. They try not to show off about it. They're likable boys, and they found that the British are likable people. They get used to left-hand traffic in a couple of days, and to English speech in a couple of weeks. One American sailor summed it up in a sentence.
You can understand what these people mean. They don't say it right.
The Yanks have found that simply because an Englishman carries a handkerchief in his sleeve doesn't mean he's a sissy. They found that even though he may pile peas, potatoes, and meat on the back of his fork and poke it into his mouth with his left hand, he's a perfectly nice guy and can often shoot well with both hands. You look at the faces of these British people in London, faces that come from Wales and Scotland and Yorkshire and the banks of the Tyne and the banks of the Severn, and you might as well be looking at Americans on the banks of the Hudson or the Mississippi. There are differences, sure. They don't go to movies, they go to the cinema. They call a druggist a chemist. And you can't buy books and lawnmowers and sun lamps in a chemist shop. They think baseball is childish. You think cricket is dull. So what? So nothing. You walk down busy Oxford Street, and you realize that the mingled British and Americans around you share more than the street and the time of day. They share the hopes and fears and aspirations of the common people of the world. They share the experience of having fought 25 years ago for a Europe that wouldn't bother us anymore. And they share the mistake of having assumed that they could live happily ever after Versailles, each on his own island, and to hell with the Chinese and the Jews and the Czechs and the Spaniards. These war-worn people passing you on Tottenham Court Road know us Americans better than any Englishman before them. One of them said only yesterday,
"It's taken this war to make us see that Americans aren't all gangsters or people who drive fast cars and live in great estates with no visible means of income. They're most of them small-town boys who haven't seen any more bright lights or big city life than our boys from Lincolnshire or the West Riding. They work with their hands and they fight with their hands, the way we do."
You walk down Charing Cross Road, and you think of the American soldier who told the Raisberry farmer he was only paying him back when he worked for him. And it comes to you at Leicester Square that for the first time since Adam, a common enemy has made common friends of the common man in all quarters of the globe, all the way from Brazil to Moscow, from China to the Cape of Good Hope. The Yanks stop off in England. The Dutch Queen addresses congressmen in Washington. Boys from Brooklyn hold the beach at Tulagi. The government of Mexico renames a town Lidice to perpetuate the memory of miners murdered by Germans in Czechoslovakia. You pull up at a statue in front of the National Gallery. It's a statue of George Washington. It's been there for some years.
You've been listening to the Columbia Broadcasting System's presentation of The Yanks Are Here, the fifth of a limited series of six programs under the title of An American in England, written and directed by Norman Cohen and brought to you by CBS direct from England through the facilities of the British Broadcasting Corporation. Joseph Julian narrated, and the original musical score was composed by Benjamin Britten and performed by the Orchestra of the Royal Air Force under the baton of Wing Commander R.P. O'Donnell. The program was produced by Edward R. Murrow. Your announcer was John Snagg. We return you now to New York.
An American in England will be heard next Monday, 1 hour earlier, at 9 p.m. Eastern Wartime. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
An American in England, on Tuned to Yesterday from August 31st, 1942, from the BBC and CBS, and director and writer Norman Corwin. That wraps up this hour of True History. On Tuned to Yesterday, be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's yesteryear. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for tuning in.